Metcast, Tuesday, June 12th, 2018. Hey, Mech Geeks, it's time for your Mechcast, the show for Mech Geeks by Mech Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the Mechcast. Hope you are having a wonderful week. Looking here over the show notes, we got a few things to talk about this week in the world of Apple and Macintosh. We're going to talk about if your next iPhone might cost a little bit less than it did last year. There's some rumors floating around that it just might. We're going to talk about future iPad models and what might be on there and what might not. Also, got a lot more details about what it's going to take to bring those iOS apps over to your Mac. Some information coming out of Worldwide Developer Conference. We have a little bit more details. Some new TV shows and programs making their way into Apple's staple of upcoming original content. And also a little issue with Apple Watches that Apple doesn't seem to be acknowledging, but I have a feeling, actually, I know is out there because I had an issue with this one myself. So we're going to talk about all that, and then we're going to get into some feedback. I have some proof that Face ID is not as good as Touch ID, and I know that's controversial, and I'm sure you're going to want to weigh in on that one. What happened to FaceTime and it being opened? We're going to talk about that a little bit, and some backup stuff, and also I have a great thing of the moment for you, something that's I'm kind of cheating a little bit because it's not really a thing of the moment. It's something I've used for a long time, but it came up in the moment this week and I want to tell you about it. So it should be a great episode. I don't want to waste any time. I just want to jump right into the news. Kicking things off, we have Ming-Chi Kuo. Yep. KGI securities analyst, or former now KGI securities analyst, still doing the Apple stuff. It was unclear when he changed jobs if he was still going to be making predictions about Apple, but here he is making predictions about what Apple might do on its future products. He shared his opinions on Apple's pricing strategy for their 2018 iPhone models with his investors in a research note. And if you were not happy about the pricing of the iPhone X and the above $1,000 price tag, 2018 might be a better year for you with the updated versions of the iPhone X. He says he's looking for Apple to bring prices back down below that $1,000 US level starting point, and that would include even the new larger 6.5-inch OLED iPhone X Plus, the large model we're expecting Apple to release this year. He thinks the price of the Plus models could be between $900 and $1,000 US, and that means that the 5.8-inch model, the update to this year's iPhone X, could come in starting at as low as $800, $800 to $900, Ming-Chi Kuo thinks. So that's pretty good, right? Bringing it back down, still a lot of money for a cell phone. Of course, Apple's going to have a whole range of products, including that new lower-cost iPhone. We'll talk about the pricing on that here in just a second. But as far as why Apple's bringing the pricing down, he cites a few factors, including, quote, concern over the negative impact of a higher price. Something we've been hearing. I don't necessarily kind of buy into that argument that iPhone X sales suffered because of the higher price tag. I think they did just fine. But he also says better predicted yields and cost reductions are on components are a factor. And I think they're actually a larger contributing factor in the prediction. You know, Apple's able to get parts at a lower cost. They can bring the pricing back down. They've kind of figured some things out with the iPhone X model. That was a lot of new technology in there. And anytime we have new technology, that pushes things up. And Apple likes to get their average selling price point up. They don't like to lose money. They like their big margins. So now that costs have come down a little bit, I think they're going to pass that savings on. And that is something that's a little bit new. Typically, when they push a price point up, they leave it there as they bring out new models. So that would be a change this year. And you could argue that maybe Apple is doing that because they have to reflect the price sensitivity of the smartphone market. It's become a mature market. It's much more competitive. People are upgrading less frequently. So you need to incentivize them a little bit. And that has happened historically with all products. I don't think it's a sign of any trouble or problems for the iPhone. It's like we've talked about here a lot on the MacCast, just like they did with the iPod. You know, you had high price points in the early days, new models would come out, they'd be higher priced. As you get to a mature product, when people start moving on to other devices or upgrading less frequently, those prices are going to slowly climb back down. So I think Apple did want to push the price point up a little bit, get us used to those higher prices. So when they bring them back down to the quote unquote normal price, it actually feels like we're getting a deal, doesn't it? And as I mentioned, he also thinks that Apple's rumored LED 6.1 inch entry model, and he didn't reconfirm that that's going to be a 6.1 inch model. That's the rumor that's been floating around for a while. I think Apple's going to go with something about that size. But that LED model could come in priced between $600 and $700 US. And of course, they're going to have all the other models, the iPhone 8 models, coming down in price and becoming even more affordable entry options in the iPhone lineup. So Apple should have a good range of products going into 2018 and the holiday season there. And for release date, he expects an announcement in September, with the new models on sale in a couple weeks after the announcement. So they should be on sale in September as well. We'd heard some rumors that there might be some delays, and that still could happen, right? It's still pretty early, but right now it looks like Apple is targeting a September release for the new 2018 iPhone models. We've also had some reports that Apple might be a little bit more conservative about the numbers of phones that they have available at launch. And of course, anytime that happens, we're hearing people, you know, ring the doom and gloom alarm bells, saying that, you know, iPhone sales is slipping and Apple is doomed. Apple is reportedly ordering about 100, or Apple reportedly, excuse me, ordered about 100 million iPhone 8, 8 Plus, and 10 models in 2017. This year's three phone lineup, that would be that 5.8 inch model, the new 6.5 inch OLED iPhone 10 Plus, and the LED lower cost model, that three phone lineup, they're saying Apple is ordering more in the range of about 80 million units. So it has Wall Street spooked. Apple's stock even took a little hit on the news. And so is it a sign that Apple doesn't expect to sell as many iPhones this year? Nope, I don't think so at all. As a matter of fact, I think it's pretty stupid, because what were we just talking about? Major parts of the supply chain have already worked out a lot of bugs on many of the new components, specifically all of those little sensors and things that go into the true depth camera system. Yeah, those little bugs have been worked out. A lot of the OLED panel things, while they're still in short supply, things are a lot better. So Apple can really get more parts more quickly, and if they need to ramp up the supply chain, they can do that. So of course, Apple's going to do the smart thing, be a little bit more conservative about their orders and launch estimates, see how customers respond to the various models in the lineup, which products are selling well, which are maybe not selling as well, and then they can make adjustments, and they can do that much more rapidly. In the past, you'd have to build up inventory because you couldn't make those kinds of adjustments. They're going to have more ability to do that in 2018. And these are just my own theories, but based on a lot of historical evidence about how Apple operates on these things. So I would bet in the end, at the end of 2018, Apple will have sold actually more models of the iPhone than they did in 2017. I think 2017, and Apple did very well with iPhone sales, was a little more tepid. I think there's a lot more people waiting to update to the 2018 models. There's going to be more options in the lineup. That new lower cost entry level model is going to be very attractive. All of the models are going to have Face ID. They're all going to have the true depth camera system. So, you know, you're not going to be limited to just some of the models in the lineup. And I think Apple's going to sell a lot more iPhones. So I think it's the exact opposite of what Wall Street is responding to. And I think Apple's going to come out just fine. But we're going to have to wait until September to truly find out. Mac Rumors points out that there were several UI changes made to the iPad, specifically the iPad Pros in iOS 12. They've been playing around with it, and they're thinking that, wow, it looks like Apple moved some things around to make room for the TrueDepth camera system up there in the menu bar. They also adjusted some of the swipe gestures. Things like swiping up from the dock now brings up the home screen just like it would on your iPhone X. Also, swiping down from the top right corner brings up the control center. And I know that doesn't work in iOS 11 because I'm constantly trying to do it and it's really annoying. So I'm going to be happy that it's going to be there in iOS 12 on my iPad Pro. I have to forget, you know, as I'm switching between my iPhone and my iPad, it gets really confusing. So I'm happy that these gestures are becoming similar on both the iPad and the iPhone. They also did note that the status bar has been changed with the time, day, and date. They are now located on the upper left-hand side of the screen, and your Wi-Fi, LTE connection, Bluetooth status, and battery are over there on the right. So they're split across what is now a virtual notch on the iPad Pro models because they don't have the TrueDepth camera system yet. So theory there is, hey, Apple is going to be bringing TrueDepth to future iPads. And that rumor's been around there, around from several sources. We've talked about it here on the MacCast. It's also believed we're going to get thinner bezels and also no home button designs for future iPads, at the very least the iPad Pro models, but it's looking like Apple's going to go that way moving forward. I think more and more we're going to see almost every model of iOS device taking on that design, and it's not going to be a big surprise to anyone. There is some debate about the notch itself, though. So loss of the home button, TrueDepth camera system, but will the iPad get a notch? And some people are thinking not, that Apple could just integrate it right into the bezel because they have a little bit more room on the iPad to play around with. I think the design changes to iOS 12 and just the fact that the notch is such a visual indicator of an Apple product now, it's so associated with Apple because of the iPhone X, I think it's really a branding feature as much as a necessary design feature. So I firmly believe that Apple's going to go with a notch on future iPad models, like it or not. So if you don't like it, you're probably going to have to start to get used to it because I think it's going to be around with us for at least a few years until Apple can figure out how to integrate some of the sensors right behind the display. And they do have patents for a lot of that stuff. They just haven't been able to develop the technology yet. So I think eventually we will get a lot of the sensors being hidden directly behind or integrated into the display panels. And that'll be pretty cool to see when that happens. But we're several years, my guess is, away from that. There's some more new stuff in iOS 12 that's been reported on. I just wanted to hit some of the highlights. TechCrunch reported that Apple will add a live listen feature for your AirPods in iOS 12. There's some indicators in there. I don't think it's quite working yet. Live listen is actually an accessibility feature. It was announced in 2014 when Apple did a lot of their stuff with accessibility and hearing aids. What that allowed hearing aids at the time to do, or certain hearing aids to be able to do, would be to pair up and tap into the microphone that was on the iPhone. So you could actually physically move your iPhone closer to a person in a loud room and then get the audio in your hearing aid from that. Looks like they're going to be adding that feature for AirPods in the future. So your iPhone can now become a remote microphone for your AirPods. That sounds really, really cool to me. And the option right now is in there in settings. It's in, and you actually can add a new hearing button into the control center. So once you've enabled the feature, it looks like you'll be able to turn it on or off from the control center by adding a control center button. And that sounds really neat to me. It also makes me think that we all have kind of some audio spying devices on us if we have a set of AirPods and an iPhone, so be careful. You know, you could operate that from across the room, but intentionally it's supposed to be, if you have a hard time hearing your television, maybe you could actually move your iPhone, put it close to the speaker, and put your AirPods in and sit back. Of course, you could pair it with your Apple TV or something like that, but if you've got other people in the room and other people are listening, this new live listening feature might come in pretty handy. Another big deal was made at WWDC about iOS 12 was about how fast it was going to run, especially on older devices, that Apple was really working on performance. A lot of reports out there saying, yep, I installed iOS 12 beta and it's running awesome, even on my iPhone 5S or my 6 or my 6 Plus. and it feels so much snappier, and it definitely is faster. There is no doubt about it. We're seeing some speed tests. Apple says it's faster. I fully believe them. But we're starting to see some real world head-to-head speed tests between iOS 11 and iOS 12. And I have to say, it's faster, but this isn't going to, it doesn't feel like it's going to change anyone's life. I don't know. I think it's a little crazy. I think it's a little hypey, if you ask me. Quote, this is an actual real quote. The TV app launched almost instantly on iOS 12, where it took a full 3 seconds on iOS 11. And that is a big difference, right? That is a huge performance difference on a percentage scale. But are we serious about 3 whole seconds? Is that like death to someone that an app might take 3 seconds to launch? I mean, how did we survive with iOS 11? And that's a really extreme case. In most cases, I'm seeing apps in these speed tests launching within a tenth of a second or tenths of seconds between each other. So while it might take, you know, 1 second on iOS 11, it's launching on iOS 12 in 0.9 seconds. It's really not that huge a difference. Yes, things are coming up a little bit quicker, but when you see these head-to-head things, it's just not that extreme. So it makes me wonder, you know, were we all maybe crying a little bit too much or complaining a little bit too much because we felt like iOS 11 was really, truly slow on our old devices? And I get it. I know that anything faster is better because in aggregate, it makes a big difference. I'm not saying this isn't a good thing. I'm not saying that Apple focusing on speed improvements is not a good thing. But I am also cognizant enough to know that these days we're a little bit spoiled when it comes to the speed of our devices, right? I have to remember going back and using things like the original iPhone. Do you remember how long we had to wait for a page to load? It was 10 seconds, 20 seconds, 30 seconds, and we were kind of happy about it at the time. And I know progress and all those things, but I just found it a little bit funny, right? Speed, faster is always better, even a little bit faster. It is a good thing, but I'm trying to put it in perspective. And I was expecting when I guess part of my thing is I was a little bit disappointed when I saw these head-to-head speed tests because I was expecting a huge visual difference in launching of apps and bringing up share sheets and the keyboard and stuff like that. And it's not as big a difference as you would think in your mind when you hear 40% faster, 50% faster. We're talking tenths of a second in most cases, and maybe 1 or 2 seconds or 3 seconds in the most extreme of cases, at least the ones that I've seen. And I get that it's beta, so it's only going to get better. It's a good thing, but I just found it a little bit funny and I wanted to share that with you. Of course, you're always welcome to chime in and share your opinions and tell me why I'm a giant doofus and totally wrong. I'm totally fine with that. You can send your emails, audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. Another quick thing, watchOS 5 beta was quickly pulled after Apple launched it. It sounded like it was maybe bricking some people's devices. So just another warning to say, hey, don't be installing beta software on your critical devices. Apple did fix it out and rolled it out with a new batch of betas. They actually put out beta 2, I think, for everything, including Apple TV and iOS and macOS and watchOS. And whatever was wrong was fixed. They didn't really say what was wrong with it, but something was wrong. I've also talked to a number of people who are beta testing iOS 12 and macOS. And while a lot of the reports are saying things are running very, very well, everything is absolutely not perfect. I've talked to a number of people who are like, this app and that app doesn't work. A lot of apps crash. It works fine for a little bit and then things go wrong and I'm having to reset and restore. So remember, that's the kind of thing that you're in for if you're going to be running betas. Use an extra device, dual boot your Mac if you want to do something like that. Install it on an external if you want to just test and play around, but it really is beta software. It's not meant to be running production applications and things like that. So fair warning on that. I know we bring it up all the time, but you'd be surprised. It gets really sad when I get an email from a listener who says, hey, all this stuff has gone wrong with my iOS device. And a lot of times they won't tell you up front, but I email back and say, hey, are you running the betas? And then they begrudgingly admit, yeah, I'm running the betas. I probably shouldn't be. I don't know how to roll back, all those sorts of things. So backup, of course, but also don't be running on your main devices. As I promised at the top, we got a little bit more detail on exactly what it's going to take for developers to take those iOS apps and port them to the Mac. Apple gave a little bit of preview at Worldwide Developer Conference. They mentioned that this year they're going to be trying out the new frameworks and the new methodologies for building apps with Xcode, porting iOS apps to Mac using their own applications. They showed off, what was it, the Home app, voice recording, the news app, and there's one more that I'm, of course, forgetting. But they didn't give a lot of details. Well, Craig Federighi actually did a Wired interview and talked a little bit more about how things are going to work. First off, he said that they've been working on these frameworks for actually about 2 years at Apple. So this isn't a new project. This isn't a new concept. It's obviously something they've been thinking about for a little while. And he pointed out that, you know, really iOS and macOS, they share this kind of common kernel. They have a lot of common sets of frameworks for things like graphics and audio and layout display. But, you know, when it comes to actual interaction, a lot of the user interface, of course, has to be very different. You have, you know, minimize and maximize and close buttons on the Mac. You don't have those things on iOS. On iOS, you have swipe gestures. Of course, some of those work with the trackpad on a Mac, but not every Mac has a trackpad. Some have mice. So interactions are a little bit different. So Apple had to work out that part of the problem. And so what they ended up doing was taking parts of what is called UIKit, the thing that controls a lot of that stuff on the iOS interface, and they leveraged bits and pieces and integrated that in to the and sort of added it on to AppKit, which is the thing that does all that stuff on the Mac, and it allows iOS developers to be able to basically take their app and target the Mac just like they would an iPhone, iPad, or Apple TV. And in some cases, depending upon how the app was built, it might be as simple as that to port it over to the Mac. Now, most applications are going to require a little bit more work from the developer. They're going to have to do some things. It's really going to depend on how the app was developed. There's going to be a whole range. Some are just going to work. Some are going to require serious and major adjustments and changes to be able to work on the Mac. I imagine that the majority of apps are going to fall somewhere in the middle. There was a great example given in the piece where there's actually an API that turns a long press, what would be a long press on iOS, into a two-finger click on the Mac. And so there, that's handled. That's something that's handled automatically sort of for free, but you have to imagine, okay, what happens after that long press? Well, if it brings up a contextual menu, that might work just fine. But if it does something else, there might be a little bit more programming behind the scenes that the developer needs to do to get that to work on the Mac. He did stress that having different chip architectures really didn't make a difference. The interviewer asked about that, sort of alluding to the fact of, you know, is Apple going to be going to their own processors on the Mac in the future? Federighi, of course, didn't comment specifically on that, but he did say that at least at the development level, at the Xcode and programming level, the chip architectures don't really work that differently, so they don't, developers don't have to worry about that, basically, importing the applications. That's all handled by Xcode and the entire platform. So that is out of the way, and that's good news, I would imagine, in the future where Apple may be designing their own chips for Macintoshes. iOS apps ported to macOS also won't be forced into the App Store. They talked about that in there. And developers can still set pricing and sell the apps wherever they want. Of course, Apple's encouraging them to go into the App Store, but they don't have to do that. In fact, starting in macOS Mojave, app developers can notarize their apps. And Apple talked about this a little bit at Worldwide Developer Conference. And what that does is it allows them to submit the app to Apple, get it notarized and sort of authorized that it's not doing anything nefarious, that it's clean code, it's code written to Apple's standards, basically. This is my understanding of it after some brief reading. So take that with a grain of salt, but this is my understanding of it. And then Apple will notarize the application, meaning the developer can then sell it outside the App Store but it will still run even if you have Gatekeeper turned on. Right now, if you get an app outside the App Store, even though it's signed with a developer certificate, you have to open it up in that special way, right, where you right-click on it and you say open and you allow it to run even when Gatekeeper, you know, if Gatekeeper's turned on, or you have to turn off Gatekeeper. Well, with notarized apps, it's going to be a more seamless process for developers. So that gets a little bit better. And Federighi also did stress that that was not a full app review. Developers, to get an app notarized, they don't have to meet all of the same guidelines that they would for selling in the Mac App Store. So there should be some good options for developers. Another thing that Apple announced at Worldwide Developer Conference was that beginning with macOS Mojave, they were going to have deprecated support for a couple of technologies that specifically gaming applications tend to rely on currently, and that's OpenGL and OpenCL, and they're kind of pushing developers to move toward the Metal APIs and Metal 2. And I don't think that should be really shocking. OpenGL on macOS High Sierra, for example, still uses version 3.3 of OpenGL, which was developed in 2010. The current version was released in 2017. It's version 4.6. So Apple is sort of moved on to their own technologies, Metal and Metal Performance Shaders, for a while, and they've been recommending that to developers working on the Mac. Now, OpenGL and OpenCL, a lot of developers like, because they are open platforms. A lot of the libraries and technologies that they can pull into Xcode use those technologies, and it makes it great for building apps. Apple's basically taken a lot of the functionality of those two technologies, rolled them into a single Apple API in the form of Metal, and that's what they want developers to use. Well, this whole move has sort of upset some developers. Now, Apple did announce that it's deprecated. That means OpenGL and OpenCL stuff is still going to work in Mojave, but they're just notifying developers, hey, in the future, these technologies are going away. I don't even think they've commented specifically to say that they're not going to be there after macOS Mojave, but writing's kind of on the wall. They probably won't be. But why this upsets some developers is that that Metal is a proprietary technology. It is an Apple technology. It does not work cross-platform, and it's not open like OpenGL and OpenCL. It also means that in the future, at some point, some older games might stop working. So if you have older titles that you've purchased, they're running and working on your Mac now, they're relying on OpenGL or OpenCL technologies, those will break as Apple takes that functionality out of the operating system. So you'll either have to run it on older hardware or older versions of the operating system. And it also means that developers developing games are going to have to specifically target the Mac and the PC separately, because they're going to have separate graphics engines. Graphics engines and libraries developers use to develop games, though, have been expanded, and a lot of them support both Direct3D and Metal technologies, and just some of them don't. And so those libraries are either going to have to be adapted, or if not, developers are going to have to find new ones. And that means some developers will make the choice to simply not port their titles to the Mac. And that could mean that we end up with fewer indie titles and not as many non-first tier title games getting ported to the Mac. Again, not anything that I think we're not all that used to. And even with these technologies like OpenGL and OpenCL, just because of the size of the Mac gaming market, it's not something that a lot of companies and developers really target. We get a lot more stuff on iOS because it's a larger platform, but certainly on the desktop, on the Mac, we've dealt with these things for a long time. But there is some concern in the community that Apple forcing developers onto Metal is going to push things back in the other direction, because we have seen some growth in recent years, right? It's gotten better for Mac gaming, and the concern is by deprecating these APIs or deprecating support for OpenGL and OpenCL that we might be taking a step back. So a lot of that was being talked about in the community this week. I am not a huge gamer, so this doesn't impact me all that much. So my general feeling on it is that you know, games that run on Metal and Metal 2 perform much better on a Mac. I think the experiences are much better on a Mac. And again, because Apple hasn't been actively supporting the latest versions of OpenGL, I don't see this as as big an issue as the community is maybe making it out to be, but I'd love to hear from some of you who are gamers, specifically gamers who game on the Mac. How do you feel about this? Because we did just get to the point where we have, external eGPU support, and that should be huge for gaming. But if you can't get the titles you want because the developers don't want to build for Metal or Metal 2, I guess that's a pretty big deal, and that could be pretty disappointing. I have a feeling, though, we're still going to get those top-tier games. We're going to get the big titles that most people want, and it's more of the indie stuff. And I like a lot of the indie stuff, don't get me wrong, but I think a lot of the indie stuff ends up showing up on iOS just because of the potential marketplace. So I think there's kind of a balance there, but I could be totally wrong on this stuff. Shoot me some feedback. Send me an email, maccast@gmail.com. Another thing that came out of Worldwide Developer Conference was a little change that Apple made that means developers will basically be able to offer free trials of their applications on the App Store. And this would be for non-subscription apps. And some developers are not actually happy with the way Apple is handling this because they're saying, hey, it's not true free trials. What you're doing is you're allowing us to sell a zero sum or a zero cost version of pro version of the application for a limited time. And then you have to, through in-app purchase, basically enable the pro features after the trial period. So it's basically a change to the guidelines that lets developers continue to do something that actually a lot of them were doing already. And what they're saying is the problem with this is that, you have to sell the app as a free app in the App Store. It's targeted as a free app, so it shows up in the free section, and also that it then has in-app purchase. So it's a little bit confusing to the consumer that this is actually truly a paid app, to get all of the functionality and features. You are going to have to pay for it, but it's showing up for free. And that confuses consumers, and then consumers get angry when they find out that they can't use all the functionality of the app. And that is completely understandable, and I totally agree with that. It also has some other limitations because it is a free app with in-app purchase. You can't offer it for bulk purchase. So if you're targeting corporations and things like that, you have to either build a different version or not offer it in the App Store that way. It doesn't support family purchases because, again, in-app purchases don't get shared across a family. And another problem with having it be a free app that then enables for free all of the pro features means that when it drops back after that trial period, if you have an app that is that only works when you're paying for it, right, you're going to have a lot of angry customers there. So you can't go back and kind of fully cripple the application after the trial because customers are going to be, not happy. They now have an app that doesn't do anything that they downloaded from the App Store. So some developers have gotten around this. I think Omni does this with things like Omni Outliner, where it basically becomes a read-only app. So you can open Omni Outliner files, but you can't edit them until you actually pay the pro standard or pro upgrade price through in-app purchase. But that could be frustrating as well. Also, it kind of screws up the rankings, right? Because now you have full paid applications that are competing in the free side of the App Store in terms of the rankings and getting featured and things like that, because they're, again, technically qualified as free applications. So it's not a perfect situation. I think Apple hasn't fully recognized that, and developers, are still waiting for true free trials on the App Store. And it also doesn't seem to change what is arguably even a bigger issue for developers, and that is the lack of paid upgrades. And I talked about this a little bit on the Mac show on the British Tech Network, but I think Apple is not going for paid upgrades because I think that Apple really feels the subscription model for software is much better for developers. And if they were to offer true just paid upgrades, fewer developers would move in that direction. Now, this is just my own theory. I don't have any evidence from Apple, or I don't have any rumors from inside Apple that is their philosophy on this thing. But I think that is what a lot of developers are thinking. And this is a lot of what Apple is thinking about when it talks about how do you handle paid upgrades or recurring revenue for developers. And they think subscriptions is the way to go. And I pushed back on this a lot. And I have to admit that I am coming around on this issue. I don't like it for every application. I don't think it's the perfect model for everything. But for a lot of the apps I use, especially the professional apps, the productivity apps, the ones that I really rely on, I'm happy to pay a certain amount per year. I prefer the ones that don't just do month to month, but actually offer a yearly subscription renewal. So if it's $20, $30, $40 for something that I use for my business a year, I think that's a reasonable price to pay. And what I really like about it is once I'm doing that, the developer's getting recurring revenue. They can continue to support and develop new features in the app. They don't have to hold back features and wait until they get enough to put in a release that's going to make me want to pay the, you know, paid upgrade price. And I, you know, frankly, when they were doing it that way, I was buying the upgrade every year anyway. So they'd put out new features every year. I'd pay the paid upgrade price. If the subscription price is about that same level, it kind of ends up not being any different. And I know this is definitely controversial, and I'm going to hear from many of you who feel very differently about this. I know people who vehemently hate the subscription model. But I have subscription model on a number of my, again, pro tools that I use. And for the stuff that wasn't as important to me, stuff that I might buy from a developer and then not upgrade for several years, there's turning out to be a lot of free and almost free alternatives, or very inexpensive alternatives, to replace some of those. And that's unfortunate for those developers who were making their living that way off those apps. But again, that's looking like what the future is going to look like. And I think, you know, maybe not directly, but indirectly, by Apple not so many years later offering a paid upgrade option for apps on the App Store or the Mac App Store, I think they're sort of signaling what I thought years ago, was that Apple thinks subscription model for selling software is the future. Again, just my opinion, but I'd love to hear your thoughts on it. All right, Apple has ordered a couple of new shows to add into their growing staple of shows for what is rumored to be Apple's original content service. We don't know how that's going to be rolled out, if it's going to be part of Apple Music or they're going to form some sort of new service that we're going to have to pay for. But this week we heard about a half hour dramedy called Little Voices that's going to be produced by J.J. Abrams and Sarah Bareilles. It's described as a love letter to the, quote, diverse musicality of New York, which explores the universal journey of finding your authentic voice in your early 20s. Yeah, I don't know what that means either. It also doesn't sound like a show that I would necessarily be interested in. I may give it a shake because I really like those two people, J.J. Abrams and Sarah Bareilles. Bareilles is also going to debut original songs in the first 10 seasons. It's a 10-episode season order, I guess. And screenwriter Jesse Nelson, who has worked on I Am Sam and Stepmom, those two movies, is going to actually serve as a showrunner and will also write, executive produce, and direct the first episode. Variety has also reported that Apple has earned the TV adaptation rights, to Gregory David Roberts' 2003 novel, Shantaram, I think that's how you say it. Sorry if I'm mutilating that to fans of that story. Not one I'm familiar with, but critically acclaimed. It's a story of a convict named Lynn who flees an Australian prison and disappears into the city of Bombay. There he finds new life in the slums, bars, and underworlds of India. The show is going to be produced by Paramount Television and Anonymous Content. And American Hustle screenwriter Eric Warren Singer is going to serve as showrunner and executive producer on that show. So a couple of other new shows we're hearing about. And again, Apple's sort of lineup is building up with a lot of things that I'm pretty excited about. A few other recent shows, I don't remember if we've mentioned these here on the MacCast. There's going to be a half-hour show about the life of poet Emily Dickinson, starring Haley Steinfeld. and also an adaptation of the Isaac Asimov series Foundation, which is being created by Skydance Television. They make a lot of really cool stuff that I like to watch. I can't think of anything off the top of my head, but I remember the Skydance Television logo on the back of a lot of shows that I'm into. And also, there's going to be an animated series from the creators of Bob's Burgers called Central Park. Those are just a few of the newer ones. There is an ever-growing list. If you search for this stuff online, I'm most excited about Amazing Stories, which is actually going to be run and written by the same guys that have been responsible for the ABC show Once Upon a Time. And I think their writing and their creativity is brilliant. And I'm looking forward to seeing what they bring to that series. I can't wait for Apple to bring this stuff out. You know, they've built this large team of folks focused on bringing original content series to Apple. It's headed by former Sony executives Zach Van Omberg and Jamie Ehrlich, and they're operating out of this amazing studio space called the Culver Studios in Culver City, California, just near Hollywood. And supposedly it's amazing. They've got studios there, and it was a place that HBO was going to move into. I guess they backed out of that, and Apple jumped in and took that space. And they've been meeting with all kinds of amazing creative people in the world of Hollywood. And I think they're going to do some amazing things. I'm really looking forward to it. No word on, again, how Apple's going to incorporate those new series into their services, but Apple definitely wanting to grow their services business, which is becoming more and more a staple behind what Apple is doing. And it's expected that we'll hear more about exactly what they're going to do sometime in 2019. So they're buying up these shows, producing a lot of them, and they're going to start rolling them out sometime in 2019. So not this year, but next year. And I'm sure we'll be talking a lot more about this when we know exactly what they're going to do with the service. All right, last thing in the news for this week. Much like Nicolas Cage and Travolta, it looks like some Apple Watches are losing their faces, face off. Although they're not actually swapping them, so you're not taking the face from one Apple Watch and putting it on the other, like those two guys did. But I typically don't cover lawsuits, but it looks like enough people have had the problem with their original Apple Watch, their Series 1, Series 2, or Series 3 Apple Watches, for a class action lawsuit to be filed. Basically, what's happening is the faces are just falling off the Apple Watch. A complaint was filed in the Northern California District Court. It alleges that Apple has sold millions of watches that have this defect throughout the United States knowingly. They say Apple has denied the existence of the defect, claiming that it is the result of accidental damage caused by the consumer. Of course, the lawsuit alleges that it is not. And Apple did acknowledge a similar issue that was happening due to swollen batteries on some Series 2 models, and was actually causing the battery to swell and then push the face off of the watch. But that is actually different from what is being alleged here. All I can tell you is this, and this is the main reason that I'm bringing this up on the show and covering it. If you remember, I had this issue. I had my Series 2 Apple Watch. The face just fell off of it one day. I picked it up, I went to use the touchscreen, and boop, the face fell off. I had actually noticed that there was around the edges what looked like some separating. I could actually feel sort of where the watch face was meeting the side of the glass on the watch. And then, lo and behold, it just sort of fell off. It was like the glue failed. I made a Genius Bar appointment. I took it into Apple. Originally, the genius there said, yep, I know what this is. It was a Series 2, so I think he was thinking it was the battery issue. He looked in there and said, I think you have a swollen battery. Let me send this to the repair depot. They sent it to the repair depot, and the repair depot denied the repair. They said, nope, the battery is not swollen, so it's user damage. You did this, and we're not going to repair the watch. We're going to send it back to you. I had to call and speak to senior advisors and explain, no, it literally just fell off. I escalated myself up. I had to fight a bit, and ultimately they agreed for one time only. That's their kind of new thing that they'll tell you. One time only, we'll make an exception. We will repair this, and they did repair the watch and send it back to me. So this is a thing. It happens. It happened to me, so I know people aren't making this up. How widespread it is, how big an issue it is, that I don't know. And I'm going to turn to the community. Has this happened to you? Have you had to pay for a repair? Do you think this is a legitimate complaint? I think Apple does maybe have a problem here. I think it's maybe just an issue with the glue and maybe heat. I don't really know, because the watch didn't break. It was actually fully functional. The face just separated. I even thought about just super gluing it back on, but I knew that would mean that the water resistance rating would not be where it should be. So I wanted to make sure it was done properly. And so it's something that's happening. And one other thing related to Apple Watch, not related to the lawsuit, but one other last bit of Apple Watch news. Fast Company is reporting that Apple could replace the Apple Watch side buttons and digital crown with Taptic versions as soon as this year. They're saying the Apple Watch update this year might even get this technology. So the crown would still scroll, it would still turn, but the push portion of it, you know, pushing the digital crown and also the side button, those would be replaced with Taptic engines and Taptic haptic feedback. And they're saying Apple's wanting to do this to improve the reliability of the devices, right? Because if you don't have a physical button, it's not going to break. And also the water resistance. And then also it would free up space inside the watch for other things, presumably more battery, better battery life. And also saying that they possibly want to use the tops of the buttons, you know, virtual buttons, as sensors. So they'd actually be a sensor, and then when you tapped on it or pressed on it, it would give you haptic feedback. It would work like a button. But they're saying they want to use those as sensors for additional health data, including improving things like the heart monitoring. So it could almost have like an EKG heart rhythm sensor on there that you could hold your finger on, and I would presume it could pull a pulse through your finger. So potential changes to the Apple Watch. I don't see that coming this year. I think Apple's going to kind of stick with the existing design, but we'll have to wait and see. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before I move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is SetApp. If you don't know what SetApp is, oh man, you got to check this out. It is an app subscription service created by the folks and developers of Clean My Mac. And it's now offering, get this, 119 apps with big names, things like Ulysses, Bartender, Amazing. These are all apps that I bought, and they're all included in this one subscription service. It is a collection of amazing apps. They have 119 right now. It grows every month. They're constantly adding to this, and this is high quality stuff. As a matter of fact, SetApp attracts more and more loyal users, which is one reason why it won the Consumer Product of the Year on Product Hunt. And there's just so many advantages of being in and on a SetApp subscription. One, the quality of apps. These are curated top tier apps. They don't just take anybody in there. They actually go in and they handpick and select some amazing apps. You get a catalog of apps that you can just browse through, search and find what you're looking for, what you're in the need of at the moment. And they have stuff in every category. So photography, productivity, lifestyle. I mean, it's just all in there. And it's already part of your SetApp subscription. So there's no added cost. You just find the app you want, you install it and use it. It's like a, you know, some people have equated it to a Netflix, right? You pay for Netflix, you're not going to watch everything on there, but there's a lot of great high quality stuff on there. And when you want it, you just watch it, just like that. You may not use every app in there, but you're going to want and use a lot of them. And it is a great value. And then, you know, on top of that, you always have access to the latest version. There's no upgrade cost because you're already subscribed. So, and, you know, finally, hey, it's affordable. Even if there's just two or three apps in there that you need, you've likely already covered the cost of your yearly subscription. Because remember, these are really high quality apps. But you don't have to take my word for it. You can get a 7-day free trial and earn 6 more months free by referring friends. Just go to setapp.com. It's $10 a month and you get access to, again, this massive library of applications. And you can check out that library at setapp.com/apps. So if you want to see everything that's in there, you're going to be blown away. Believe me, you're going to want to buy this thing. Setapp.com. I love it. It's on my machine, and I'm probably never getting rid of it. So check it out. And a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. All right. I'm gonna go off on my Face ID rant again, and I know you've probably heard some of this before, but I have proof now, thanks to iOS 12, that Face ID sucks. All right, and it doesn't really suck, okay? I'm being inflammatory just to get a reaction out of you. You know that I'm a little frustrated from time to time with Face ID. I don't think it's as good as Touch ID, the last version of Touch ID, and I've given you all my reasons why. But when I read this in iOS 12, it kind of proves that Apple's trying to work on it a little bit, which is a great thing, right? So in iOS 12, there is a new lock screen gesture that will allow you to trigger the immediate rescan of Face ID. And I know they're doing this because others out there feel my pain, right? You go to use Face ID, it doesn't unlock, you're presented with the passcode, and you're doing this whole like dance where you're turning it away from your face, or you're putting it down, you're locking it again, you're unlocking it again, you're trying to get Face ID to work, and you're doing it 2-3 times, and then the fifth time it forces you to put in your passcode, and it's super frustrating, right? Happens to me a lot. I mean, honestly, if I'm being honest with myself, I would say for me, and I know it works better for other people, but for me and a few other people that I've talked to, I would say it has about 70% accuracy on the first try. I can eventually get it to work. So it's probably really 95% accurate. I can get it to work 95% of the time, but only about 70% of the time, 60 to 70% on the first try. So I'm having to do this retry thing. So having a gesture for it is going to be really nice. I'm looking forward to this in iOS 12. In iOS 12, a failed scan, it'll still display the number pad, but along the top, it has a notification that says, swipe up for Face ID or enter your passcode. And I think you may be able to do this gesture already. I've done it where I've just swiped up or tapped the screen, and I think it'll trigger, but I think they're implicitly now telling you, hey, if you want to try another Face ID scan, do this. And I've also heard from some early beta testers of iOS 12 that actually Face ID does seem to be working better for them. So I think Apple's tweaking the software. They're making it better. And again, I fully believe, just like it was with Touch ID, the first version of Touch ID, it was really good. And the first version of Face ID, really good. But it wasn't perfect. It was not what I would call great. Over the years, Apple made it better. And Apple will make Face ID better, and they're already doing it, as near as I can tell, with iOS 12. So again, I was being deliberately dramatic and inflammatory. Don't send me really angry emails. You can send me somewhat angry emails, but just wanted to talk about that. Hey, proof that Face ID does have a little bit of a problem when compared to Touch ID, at least in my opinion. Again, your opinion might be different. Share it with me, mattgast@gmail.com. All right, remember this.
Now, FaceTime is based on a lot of open standards, H.264 video, AAC audio, and a bunch of alphabet soup acronyms. And we're going to take it all the way. We're going to the standards bodies starting tomorrow, and we're going to make FaceTime an open industry standard.
Yep, that was Steve Jobs in 2010, almost 8 years ago, by the way, saying, hey, we're going to make FaceTime open and everybody's going to be able to use it, and it's going to be cross-platform, and it's going to be great, and it's going to be awesome. And as you know, if you've used FaceTime recently, that never really happened. So this is getting renewed, this sort of debate, and the question of what happened is getting renewed because Apple announced the new Group FaceTime at Worldwide Developer Conference this year. And it's amazing. I mean, it can support 32 people, and that's awesome. Except when you realize those 32 people need to be on an iOS device or a Mac device. And if you're like me, not everybody you care about in your life only uses a Mac. Maybe we wish they did, or an iPhone or an iPad. Maybe we wish they did, but that's just not the reality of the world we live in. Some folks are on Windows, some are on Android, and wouldn't it be nice if we could make those FaceTime calls to those folks as well? So why did this never happen? What happened? Because if you listen to Steve Jobs in that keynote, he's very earnest about it. I don't think he's joking. As a matter of fact, I think they did that next day go to that board. And if you look into the history of this, the one reason that seems to be most often cited as to why FaceTime never went open is, of course, a patent dispute. Yep. I don't think technically this company is a troll, because they actually do, I believe, have some technologies that they use this stuff for. But it's Vernetx, I'm not sure how you say it, Vernetx Holding Company. They sued Apple in 2010, that same year, alleging that Apple's FaceTime technology, their VPN on demand technology, which I think is the stuff we know as Back to My Mac, and iMessage features infringed on four of Vernetx's patents. And so this has been a long drawn out lawsuit. I think it's still not resolved, although there has been some judgments and some settlements made. Starting as far back as 2016, Apple was ordered to pay $625.6 million after two of the lawsuits were kind of combined together. So there were four originally. I think they sloughed it down to three by combining two of them. There was a judgment made, but then a federal judge voided that verdict because he said combining the lawsuits into a single trial actually confused some of the jurors and was unfair to Apple. So then he ordered that they be retried separately. In October of 2017, a Texas judge ordered Apple to pay Vernetx $439.7 million in damages, and then that was later raised to $502.6 million in damages in April of 2018. So I believe that's what Apple currently owes Vernetx, at least according to the judgments, although all of it could be for naught, and there's a little bit of irony behind this, because the Patent Trial and Appeals Board actually in 2016 invalidated all four of these Vernetx patents. So the patents aren't even valid, although, you know, 2 years later in 2018, Apple is ordered to pay damages based on those. So I don't know if this stuff is being appealed. I couldn't really find in the research that I did exactly how this all works at this point. I think Apple's still appealing. I don't think it's gone all the way to the Supreme Court yet, and it probably will. So it's going to be a long time before any of these monies get paid out, if at all. But the irony is that because of all of that, because of this patent dispute stuff, that is very likely why we haven't seen an open FaceTime standard, because when this all happened, Apple had to rewrite how the FaceTime technology actually worked. It used to be point to point. So it would go from iPhone to iPhone or iPhone to Mac, and Apple didn't have any involvement. But because of these patents, they had to rewrite FaceTime to use Apple Relay servers. So the traffic actually goes through Apple's cloud and not direct. And my assumption is that Apple hasn't been able to open it up because anybody who wanted to provide FaceTime service would actually have to set up their own relay services, or Apple would have to provide an open, I would assume, and free relay service for anyone who wanted to use the technology. You know, there would be a cost otherwise to other companies, and it would require other companies to set up servers, and Apple would potentially, I would imagine, and this is probably something that Apple doesn't like either, they'd potentially lose control over the whole experience, right? So it's not as seamless. It doesn't work exactly the same way anymore. And I know that many things are open. There's many technologies that are open and have different experiences depending upon how they're implemented, but that's kind of not the Apple way. I'm also guessing that some parts of what Apple had to do to put it through their own relay servers, that might use some proprietary technologies. So even though they're getting around the Vernetx patents, that proprietary stuff could be things that Apple would worry about, or maybe it could potentially expose or compromise security of FaceTime in some way. I don't really know all of the details, but that's what happened with FaceTime, and that's why we don't have it. Now, could that change now that these patents were invalidated? I don't know. It's, you know, it's been 8 years since that technology was sort of put together. I have to imagine that FaceTime has changed in many, many ways, and maybe it's just technically not possible in any kind of easy way for Apple to make it open source anymore or to open it up. Maybe they're not using as many of those open, as Steve Jobs put it, alphabet soup standards that they were back in 2010. I think a lot of us still would like to see it opened up, or at the very least, hopefully Apple will make FaceTime clients finally for Windows and for Android, something that they presumably could do. So that would be the other way that Apple could handle this, is keep it proprietary, but then just open it up through client software that they develop for other platforms. And that would be amazing. And I'm hoping that that's ultimately the route that Apple goes. It'd be great if they made it an open standard and made it available to the world. But that's getting less and less likely. It's looking less and less likely that that will ever happen. But what's your thoughts on this? You know, open FaceTime, you know, has the world lost something by never getting that? Or, you know, is just having a client available to everyone, is that going to be good enough as an open standard? Send me your emails, your audio comments, maccast@gmail.com. Got an interesting email from Susan this week, actually a little frustrating one for her, but she wanted to point out something that maybe some of us in the community, myself included, haven't really thought about too much. And you may not have thought much about the apps that you've bought on the Mac App Store and what's installed on your device. Specifically, have you updated to the latest versions? Are you running the latest versions, or do you have an older version that maybe still runs just fine, but maybe isn't available on the App Store anymore? And you might be saying to me, well, why would I care about that? Why would that even matter, Adam? Because it's on my device. I can use it. The software still runs. Why would I need to be on the latest version? And why do I care if the version that I have is available in the Mac App Store? Well, turns out you might care because Apple made a little change a while back, and we talked about it on the show, but it impacted Susan this week because she was at the Apple Store, I think making a purchase and then getting her iPhone checked out, and Apple decided, hey, you know, there's enough wrong with your iPhone. We're going to replace it for you. We're going to give you a new one, which is all fine and great, and no big deal, you know, because she is a MacCast listener and knows I need to have backups. So she had plenty of backups at home. The iPhone was backed up. So give me a new one. I'll just reset it up and, you know, put everything back on there when I get home, restore it from my backup, and everything will be good. Well, she did that, and that process went totally fine. But then she got a dialog on her iPhone, and it said, unable to install Drafts 4, and in parentheses, legacy version, because, quote, the app is no longer available on the App Store. So she had Drafts 4 installed on her iPhone. It worked perfectly fine. She loved the software. No issues. But it couldn't be reinstalled because, remember, apps are no longer stored locally on your Mac. They are not reinstalled from your hard drive. They are reinstalled from the App Store. And if the developer has removed the app from the App Store, they cannot be reinstalled. Now, luckily for Susan, the new version was available. I don't think there was a charge for it, so she just downloaded the new version and was good to go. But that may not be the case for all of you. Maybe you don't want to buy the new version. You're perfectly happy with the version that you have already. What are you going to do? And also remember that newer devices and newer versions of the operating system will eventually stop supporting older 32-bit apps. So you have that issue to potentially run into as well. So even if you're on an older version of an application and it's running just fine currently, eventually it may or may not run. And as a matter of fact, if you're on an iPhone 10 and iOS 11, I believe you can't run 32-bit apps. So you may already be in that boat and have already dealt with that. But it is something to think about, especially for those of you who might be on an older device, maybe running an older version of the operating system. So all these things are coming into play. So the question becomes, what can you do? Well, the obvious thing is see if there's a new version of your application and upgrade. Make sure you're on the newest, latest version that's available from the developer and a version that is available in the Mac App Store, because then you'll have no problems restoring and reinstalling your applications. It won't be a problem. And do remember that oftentimes, and I've run into this a few times where I found out I'm running an older version of an application because guess what? The developer came out with a new version I didn't hear about it, and that new version was an entirely separate version of the application. Tweetbot does this all the time. So I'm running Tweetbot 2, and I don't even realize that Tweetbot 3 is out because it's a separate paid application on the Mac App Store. You have to go buy the new version and install it and then just dump the old version. And there's a lot of apps out there like that. So make sure you're checking in on your apps in the Mac App Store, especially the ones that you rely on day in and day out. It could be a pay again situation, and you're going to have to just bite the bullet and pay for that upgrade, which is ultimately a good thing because, again, it supports the developers that make the software that you really like. So I don't have a problem with that, but just be aware that you can sometimes miss that and you don't want to find out about it when you're trying to restore your phone, that, you know, the version that you had is no longer there, not available. You know, do that in advance. If you really want to hold on to the versions that you have already installed on your device, you're probably going to want to grab iMazing. Get yourself a copy of iMazing. And I know they're a Mac, they have been a MacCast sponsor in the past. They're not currently, but they make great software. This is a great application for a number of things, but one of the features that iMazing has is the ability to pull down the old IPA files, the iPhone application files. I think that's what IPA actually stands for, even though you know, you might have it on an iPad, or I guess, you know, maybe they made the P more generic. But the IPA files, you can download those. You can store them on your Mac again. You can export them. You can save them. You can even restore them. You can restore data from and to those IPA files, all using iMazing. It is really, really great. Now, it's a much more manual process. You kind of have to, you know, know what you're downloading and saving, and you got to save it off to a location. It's not just, you know, showing up in your iTunes Media mobile applications folder like it did back in the day with iTunes. But at least you can still do it. And so that's another way that you can archive those old applications. As a matter of fact, for a long, long time, when Apple was storing things, you know, locally, those mobile application files, the IPA files locally, I actually had set up my ChronoSync archive to keep a copy of every version of every application that I ever had installed on my phone. So I have like versions of applications going back to version one, even if they're currently on version 6 or 7. I don't know what I'm going to do with those old IPA files, but, you know, if anybody ever needs them, I have them floating around in my archive, and I'll probably have them there forever. But ever since Apple made the change, I haven't been actually backing up my applications. You tend to stay on the most latest version, so I don't worry too much about it no longer being available in the Mac App Store. But if you are worried about that sort of thing, there's a few things to think about and check out. Definitely iMazing. iMazing.com is a way to handle that. Last thing I have for you today is a thing of the moment. And as I mentioned at the top of the show, this isn't something that I just use in the moment. It's actually an application that I use fairly frequently, not all of the time, most of the time when I go to a conference or a trade show and I want to be able to take some notes. And this week I actually had WordCamp Orange County, which was a great event, by the way. If you're a WordPress developer, you should definitely check out your local WordCamp. They are great events. The two that they run here in Southern California, both the San Diego one and the Orange County one, are unbelievable. You pay $40 for 2 days of amazing speakers, and they give you at both those conferences an amazing lunch each day, and breakfast and coffee, and it's unbelievable. I don't know how they do it. They have amazing sponsors is actually how they do it. And it only costs $40. It is the best value of any conference that I go to all year for sure. Actually, all conferences I go to tend to pick have pretty good values, but this is just an amazing value. It's over and above. I went to WordCamp. What I like to do when I go there is, though, travel light. I don't want to take my whole laptop and all my outliners and all that sort of stuff. I just want to go light, and I like to take handwritten notes because I just find it a little bit more relaxing, and I'm faster at actually handwriting than I am at typing because I never learned to type. I know that's a whole other thing. There's actually, I mentioned earlier, SetApp actually has a typing tutor that I probably should download and install and use, but I haven't done that yet. So don't get on me about that. I'll learn to type someday. But I like to take handwritten notes at this sort of an event. And I also like to record the audio. And the app that I use for that is called Notability. It is my favorite app for doing this kind of stuff. I typically use a theme that is looks like a yellow legal pad. So I have yellow paper with a certain spacing of line on the paper. You can actually customize all that. You can set up a default. So the yellow legal pad style is my default. And you can build out, you know, grid paper. You can have plain paper. You can have all different colors, textures, all that sort of stuff you can set up. And you can categorize and organize your notes. So I'll tend to create a folder for whatever event I'm at and then store all of my notes in there. And there is a built-in audio recorder. So I just tap that. As a matter of fact, I use the orientation on my iPad. I flip it totally upside down so that the microphones are pointed right at the speaker, and it records amazing audio. And so you can use it in any orientation. And then I have my Apple Pencil, and it works so well with the Apple Pencil. And I can just take notes just like as if I had a pad of paper with me, and it all gets recorded. There's even a note replay feature. So when I go back, I can play the audio, and as I'm playing the audio, it redraws my notes. It actually puts everything into kind of a grayed background, and then you'll see your notes draw in over top of the light notes as you're playing the audio. And then I can pause, I can fill back in anything I might have missed or add details. Sometimes I'll have bullet pointed something, and it's like, I don't know exactly what that means, but to be able to go back right to that audio and listen to it is a really, really handy feature. You can also select all of your handwritten text and have that converted to actual text. So there's a convert to text, handwriting to text feature, and you can either convert it in place, or you can just copy the converted text to your clipboard and paste it off someplace else. I tend to keep my handwritten notes, but it's all OCR'd, it's all searchable. You can also add in items like photos or GIFs. You can put in figures and drawings. You can add a web clip, which is actually just like a web page or a website. And you can even then go back to that. So if somebody mentions a website during the talk, you can put a little preview of it right into your note. It is really, really flexible. You also have the ability to sync everything across iCloud. So if you use it on your iPhone or your iPad or multiple iPads, you can sync all your notes across. You can also have it do automated backups to your favorite web service. I know it supports Box.net and Google Drive and Dropbox. I use Dropbox on mine, so you can pick the format. I choose PDF plus audio, but you can save it as RTF or in the native Notability format, whatever you want for your backups. Quick and easy. It does it automatically. The only complaint, I guess I would say, is there is not a Mac version yet. I'm hoping that now Apple has these new APIs that maybe the developer considers converting and making Notability in a Mac version. But the iOS version is just $9.99. There are in-app purchases, but it's just for other themes. So it does have a built-in light and dark theme. They've built a few other cool color schemes into the app, and you can pay for those through an in-app purchase to additionally support the developer. But for $10, it is an incredible note-taking app. I would say for targeted at taking handwritten notes, although you can take typed notes into it as well. It just depends on your preference. I just really like it with the iPad and the iPad Pro for handwritten notes along with the Apple Pencil. I think it is great. So check it out. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at mattcast.com, but it's called Notability, and you can find it on the App Store. With that is going to do it for the show for this week. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank my show sponsor, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen for iOS and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information and details on all of their great applications by visiting smilesoftware.com/podcast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. As always, I love hearing from you. Your emails, your audio comments, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, send all of those to me at maccast@gmail.com. I know we're getting into the summer. Maybe a lot of you are busy, but it was a little light this week. I didn't get a lot of feedback this week, and I usually hear from you quite a bit. So we covered a lot of stuff in this show. I tried to throw out some controversy, get you riled up. So, you know, email at me, audio comment at me, maccast@gmail.com. Call in on the listener hotline, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. You can leave your voicemail messages there. If you need the show notes or links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And if you'd like to chat with me on social media, you'd like to see what I'm up to day in and day out, you can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast, or check out the MacCast Google Plus community at google.com/plusMacCast. But that'll do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.